Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate change is real, it's human-caused, and it will affect everyone. But the impacts will vary from place to place and person to person. And already, there are major disparities in climate impacts. For example, women are disproportionately impacted, as are those with limited financial resources. Theoretically, that means that policies aimed at limiting climate change should disproportionately benefit those people, but that's not always the case. For example, market-based solutions that might result in increased energy prices are a disproportionate burden for those already at a financial disadvantage. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI for short, is a carbon cap-and-trade program for the energy sector. There are currently 9 member states in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, and not surprisingly, many of those states also have other climate policies and programs in place. Recently, a group of independent researchers decided to see whether and how REGGI states are addressing the issue of equity in their climate policies. Jean Herb is the executive director of the Environmental Analysis and Communications Group at Rutgers University, and she's the lead author on that new report. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Heather.
Jean, we tend to think of climate equity often on these global scales, right? That developing nations are more impacted than, say, the United States. But give us some examples of how disparities in climate impacts can play out right here in the United States, in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions.
Here in the United States, even the 4th National Climate Assessment tells us that low-income communities and communities of color are less likely to have the resources and the capacity to prepare for and recover from extreme climate events. It's widely accepted and well-documented that while all people are affected by a changing climate, that some populations are disproportionately affected, and that includes communities of color, people who are lower income, indigenous populations, seniors, people with chronic health conditions, outdoor workers. So when you think about it, if you can't afford to buy an air conditioner and you live in a city that has less trees and is a lot hotter than a suburban area, and if you have asthma, increased ground level ozone as a result of high heat days may send you to the emergency room, and more likely than not, you're not going to have insurance. If you work an hourly wage job and you can't get to it because the roads are closed due to flooding, you're just not going to get paid. If English is not your first language, your ability to take advantage of recovery and social services after an extreme weather event are going to be totally limited. It's also clear that certain populations suffer from what's referred to as energy poverty, and that low-income populations, African Americans, Latinos, and others, including renters, spend a larger portion of their income on home energy costs than do other households. And as a result, what we're seeing is this heat or eat phenomena.
That's the inequity, for the most part, in the impacts of climate change. But then there's also the fact that while we would think that addressing climate change should then benefit those people, those are often the groups that are disproportionately disadvantaged by some of our climate policies. So give us some examples of how that plays out.
Well, some of what we're starting to see here is that states and cities have been and are continuing to lead the way in the United States with regard to policy. In the first 6 months of 2019 alone, 5 of the 11 states that we looked at passed new climate laws. Within the region that we looked at, most of the states have set aggressive limits to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the middle of the century. And these are generally informed by science in terms of the limits that we need to achieve to be able to forestall the worst impacts of climate change. The issues become, how do we achieve those limits in ways that deliver the benefits from reducing emissions to the populations and to the communities that are not only most impacted, but in ways that improve the communities that these people live in so that they're healthier, more prosperous, greener, and more equitable.
Why wouldn't simply reducing greenhouse gas emissions, any policy that would do that, accomplish that benefit to the communities most impacted by climate change? How could a well-intentioned policy aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions end up causing unfair and disproportionate impacts?
There's concerns in the environmental justice community that some policies, particularly policies that establish broad caps on carbon dioxide emission, that we may see individual power plants increase emissions, and that those increased emissions might occur in places where there are already historic disproportionate environmental burdens. So that's one area of concern. Another area of concern, for example, is that if we're looking at developing, for example, transportation policies that are aimed at reducing transportation emissions, which is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions here in the United States, that we need to think about who are the populations that we're aiming at. If we're thinking, for example, at electric vehicles, it is unlikely that something such as an electric vehicle rebate program is going to have significant penetration on a very low income population, because more often than not, those populations are going to be relying on mass transit. And so the challenge for policymakers is to be able to look at complementing policies such as community rideshare programs or electric mass transit, such as electric buses, that can benefit low-income populations as well. What the states are realizing is that they're not going to meet their state climate targets, those emission targets, unless they also aggressively direct their state climate programs to those disadvantaged communities.
Well, Jean Herb, you are part of a group of independent academic researchers who have looked at the role that equity issues are playing in state climate policies, specifically in the states that are within the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. How did you actually assess whether or not a policy was equitable?
Well, I think from the get-go, what I have to stress is this was not a project where we were evaluating the efforts of the states. We looked at 11 states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, as well as two states outside the region and two cities outside of the region. And it would have been very difficult to do something that was an evaluation, quite frankly, for a couple reasons. One is because this is a relatively new area, and we would not have had a benchmark to measure to, but also because the states are very, very diverse. Disadvantage in one state may have a focus on, for example, the rural poor, such as in Vermont, while in another state, the focus might be on communities with disproportionate environmental impacts. Or in another state, the focus might be on underemployed former fossil fuel workers. So we didn't do a comparison. What we did was we did a snapshot. And it was fascinating. What we found, we referred to it kind of as a period of innovation, not because we're seeing this major revolution in policy right now, but rather because we're seeing a novelty in pilot and demonstration efforts, and that those pilots and innovations will inform their experiences as they scale up.
As you look at all of these different states from your 30,000-foot vantage point, are there emerging best practices or lessons about what works and what doesn't?
Mm-hmm. So one thing certainly that comes across is that leadership from the top matters, and that while it might sound sort of commonsensical, it's important to say this, and it's important to reinforce it. We found that when mandates are set, such as directing that a certain portion of solar energy be directed to low-income households, that the agencies then really have this long leash to innovate. We also found that when the states establish mandates for the utilities, then innovation occurs as well. Another thing that we found is that process matters, and I know that sounds kind of silly, but it's true. As members of the public, we've all have a story about some time when we went to talk to some faceless bureaucrat. But what we're seeing now is that the states and the cities in our study are trying to find new ways to engage the public so that the public is actually heard and truly listened to.
Jean Herb, what I'm hearing you say is that for policies to end up being truly equitable and for them to benefit the most vulnerable communities, equity has to be a focus from the beginning. Can you give us perhaps just one example of a policy and a process that you think exemplifies that?
Here's an interesting example. There's a program in the state of Massachusetts that's called the Solar Massachusetts Renewable Target Program. Lots of the states are developing community renewable programs because community renewable programs recognize that it's difficult for a low-income renter or a low-income homeowner to afford to put solar panels on their roofs.
I mean, if you're already in energy poverty, as you said, if you're already struggling just to pay your electricity or heating bill, adding on for solar panels is just not in the picture.
Correct. So in a community solar program, the subscriber, the person, you and I, essentially buys into a solar project. And more often than not, the state requires that a certain number of the subscribers need to meet some standard. You need to be in an environmental justice community or you need to be low income. In the first round on the Massachusetts program, what the state was finding was that they didn't have the level of participation from low-income communities that they were hoping to have. Now, this is not unusual. Hmm. So to the state's credit, what they did was they opened it up and they asked for more input in terms of how are we going to fix it. So this concept of being able to bake it in from the beginning and being open to sort of experimentation and listening to the actual residents who they're working to benefit is definitely an exciting way of governance.
Jean Herb is the executive director of the Environmental Analysis and Communications Group at Rutgers University and lead author on a new report looking at equity in state climate policies in the Northeast. Jean, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.